From the yeehaws
to the yayhoos
and everything in between,
this podcast is for you.
We are so excited for this episode of the podcast. From the day that we started this, we dreamed of having Dr. Reiners on the podcast, and so we are happy we are finally able to do that. So this episode, you'll be hearing from him. He is a board-certified veterinary surgeon and also a board-certified veterinary sports medicine and rehabilitation veterinarian. So we thought that it would be great to get some advice, tips, and tricks from him and see what we can learn and spread the knowledge across the podcast. So I hope you're as excited as we are, and let's see what Dr. Reiners has to say.
We are here with Dr. Scott Reiners. He is our personal veterinarian and from Raphine, Virginia. He is an excellent performance horse vet, and we just thought that we would take the opportunity while we had it to sit down and pick his brain. So Dr. Reiners, first tell us a little bit about how you got into veterinary medicine and kind of your background.
You want me to start from childhood?
Whatever you want to do. Well, it might take a lot of years.
Because well, you're not actually from Virginia, right?
No.
Right.
I'm from South Dakota.
I like to give him crap about his age. Tell him I'm worried that he's aging out.
I'm getting old fast. Since I met you, a lot faster. Yeah. So I started in after high school. I went to vet tech school in Black Hills, South Dakota. They had a national college out there, and that was the vet tech school. And the only reason I went to college is because my counselor told me that I was too dumb to go to college, so I went to college.
Oh my gosh.
He said, you should probably look into being a laborer in a construction outfit or maybe a farmer. And I was like, are you calling farmers dumb?
Oh,
and he's like,
gosh.
Well, you don't have to be educated to be a farmer. Seriously.
Wow.
So I went to college.
Well, that was a good clap back to where you are now.
Yeah, for sure.
And then after tech school, I went to do an externship in Nairobi, Kenya with a veterinarian over there because the school wanted to build a school over there and they wanted to send people over there to entice them to put up a university over there. And then when I came back, vet techs at that time, they were not utilized very well. You were basically a modified kennel cleaner.
Kennel tech or
yeah, pretty much. That's you clean kennels because most of the places out there, they do dogs, cats, horses, cows.
Everything.
And you got to do all that crap work.
Yeah.
Answered, you know, it just... So, and it didn't pay much. I mean, as a technician, you're getting paid maybe $4 an hour.
Wow.
And which is, and the minimum wage was $2.25 or $2.35 at the time.
Oh my gosh.
So you weren't getting paid a lot of money. So I went, Dad, we always farmed. So I went back to working on the farm. And then I got to make more money, I started doing construction work on the side. And we actually built a construction company for a little while, me and this other guy. And the other guy said, you know, you should really think about going back to school. And I'm like, I don't want to go back to school. And he's like, oh, you should go back to school. So I went back to undergrad at SDSU to get my bachelor's in animal science.
Mm-hmm.
And my counselor or the person there told me that if you're going to go to vet school, you got to do this and this and this and this. And I was like, I'm not going to do that. So he goes, you'll never get in if I don't write you a reference, because nobody gets into vet school without my say-so. And I was like, oh, game on. And so I got rid of him, and I signed up for vet school, and I got in. So
wow.
I went to vet school in Kansas State, and which I really could cared less if I went to vet school or not. I didn't even want to go to any school anymore. But I did, and when I got in my senior year, there is a bunch of people that were going to do work on horses, and I didn't want to work on horses. I just wanted to go home and work on cattle.
Right, yeah.
But I knew a lot about horses because I've been bucked off enough of them. And so, because we raised a lot of horses at our place. So the one of the clinicians there said, oh, you should go do an internship. And I said, I don't want to go anywhere. I just want to go home. And
right.
She's like, I'm going to get you an internship. And I was like, whatever. If you give me an internship, I'll go. And she got me an internship at Ohio State. So I went to Ohio State and worked there for a year. And the guy there said, everybody that comes out of this internship usually goes into a residency program. And I said, I really just want to go home and do work there.
You're
and
like,
he goes,
I've been telling everybody, I just want to go home.
You should really apply to some residencies. And I was like, okay, fine. And so I applied to three or four different residencies. At that time, you had to write letters and really, you had to like campaign yourself to get into residencies because they were not readily available.
Right.
And I got a residency at Oklahoma State. I could have stayed at Ohio State, but I didn't want to stay in Columbus.
Yeah.
So then I went to Ohio State or Oklahoma State and did my residency there, and then I stayed as an emergency surgeon there for another year, and then I went out to Arizona and worked out there for a year and a half, and then
wow.
I went up to Idaho and worked there for a little while to help some people out. They were having a baby, so I went up there, and then we opened up the practice in Virginia.
Wow.
So where have you gotten all of your performance horse experience?
I made it up.
You made it up?
Pretty much. Because we didn't have it. So when I went to vet school, they never really taught you performance anything. It mm-hmm. wasn't a thing. Matter
right.
of fact, when I was in vet school, I seen one horse injected.
Nuh-uh.
Wow.
Period.
Seriously.
They didn't inject joints back then.
Wow.
They just didn't.
Right.
People, there's some vets out there that you heard about, and oh, they're injecting with this and this and this, and it was all steroids, and, you know, there wasn't a lot of clinics that did performance medicine whatsoever.
Right.
You just, you know, you have a lame horse, everything. You didn't have any technology. A lot of vet clinics, you know, you went to, and I mean, they didn't have ultrasound and things
right.
like that. And they, it just evolved that you could start seeing more and more and more.
So yeah. What was like a common, I mean, like, so if a horse would come in that was lame, like back then, I mean, what did you have, what did you guys do for things like that?
So, like, even in my residency program, we've seen a lot of lame horses.
Right.
But at, like, the universities, radiology, you had to call radiology, and radiology had to come over, and you had to say, I want this ultrasound
like
right
a hospital.
Here. Right here. Because they were the only ones with the ultrasound machines.
Gotcha.
And they would come over there and go, yeah, it looks like there's a hole in there. Okay. Well, it really didn't tell you much about it. And like x-rays, they've been around for years. But still, a lot of veterinarians out there didn't have good x-ray machines because you had to carry around plates.
Right, and then take them back to the clinic and develop them and
yeah.
all of that.
So yeah. you would be looking at an x-ray and it was like, whoa, it looks like a tinted window. Let's see. Get the hot light out, maybe we can see something on it.
Technology's came a long way.
Oh,
yes.
It did.
Yes.
And with, it was hard to shoot like backs and necks and heads and stuff because people really didn't do that because even if you got a great shot, which after a while you developed your own technique,
right?
Backs weren't really a thing that people worried about ever. It was always legs. So
yeah.
if a horse came in lame, first thing you do is grab your hoof tester, squeeze all around, and if he had any pain on his heels, oh, it was navicular disease. And then you'd get out and block him. Oh, he blocked out with a low PD block. Definitely had navicular disease. And all the navicular horses out there went on some kind of sort of a rheologic agent or something for blood flow.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, we weren't even injecting navicular bursas.
Right.
Oh, okay.
That actually came, evolved. There's a gal at Texas A&M that she really pushed injecting navicular bursas. And I remember her presenting it at an AAP meeting. So before then, I mean, nobody injected navicular bursas.
Yeah. Right.
And they all got the same shoes, wide web aluminum shoes with 3 degrees on them. All of them.
Same thing for every horse.
Yep. And even when you x-rayed them, if they didn't show any changes on them, still had navicular disease. Because
everything was navicular.
If it had heel pain, it had navicular disease. Which we know now that that's
not the case.
Not even close.
Right.
Yeah. A lot of it has to do with tendon tears, ligaments, and things like that, or inflammation in the bone, in the navicular bone, and things like that.
Right.
It's a slurry of stuff. But it was simple. I mean, you didn't have to know anything back then. But we thought we were doing the right thing, but we were
yeah.
missing so much until MRI came around. And MRI has never really came around for horses until way, like, I think the first horse was MRI'd, a live horse,
uh-huh.
like in 98, something like that.
So that's been, like, pretty
recently.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then more, and there was only very few MRIs. It's not like you can take them into the hospital here, MRI my horse.
Right.
And they were the only ones that could afford the huge MRIs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then all these other MRIs came out yeah. and more vet clinics put them in. I mean, we had one for a long time. And then now MRIs, I mean, they're doing PET scans and everything on horses now. So
it's crazy.
Technology changed a lot of sports medicine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it sure did. So I think it's interesting that you were talking about navicular bursa injections just because it's something that's kind of floating around on the internet.
I was going to ask that question.
Interesting to get your take on when is it appropriate to inject a navicular bursa, and do you ever worry about the soft tissue when you're doing it?
I worry about everything. normally we ultrasound the navicular bursas on a lot of them, and you can actually see the fluid in there if it needs to be injected or not.
Oh, okay. Okay.
A lot of times you can see if there's a tear in the deep digital flexor tendon. There's a couple of approaches that you can do to the navicular bursa. You can go straight in from the back, or you can go around to the side. If we do an ultrasound guided, we do from the side and we go down, and you miss most of the soft tissue at that time.
Okay.
You never miss soft tissue because your skin is soft tissue too.
Right.
But
right.
You miss like the deep digital flexor tendon, and that's what everybody worries about. Oh, I stuck a needle in there, and oh, he moved and he tore the deep digital flexor tendon.
Right.
Gotcha.
Well, I use like a 22 gauge needle, so it's like very small,
mm-hmm.
and we just go into the navicular bursa with that. Can you see it on ultrasound afterwards? Yeah, you can see where you stuck a needle, but you can see where you stuck a needle
and in a
anywhere,
muscle. Yeah, anywhere
in a horse. I mean, you watch me do SI injections and stuff, and you can see the needle going right in there.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Later on, you can still see where the needle went. It takes a long time because basically you're separating tissue and you're damaging tissue by sticking needles in. But the advantage of it outweighs the trauma.
Mm-hmm. Risk versus benefit. The benefit's greater. And
yeah.
I feel like that's the case with a lot of things, in not just the horse industry, but life in general. You just have to weigh out the
benefits. Yeah, I mean, you get a vaccine. I mean, they're damaging a lot of tissue. Plus, you're going to get sick afterwards, and a lot of people do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But in the long run, do you really want a polio? No.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Or smallpox. No, you don't.
Yeah.
So the advantages outweigh the trauma.
So sorry to go off road there for a second, but I just thought that was a good opportunity to ask that and good information. So back to your experience, I know that you do surgery and you're very good at it. Where did you get your surgical experience? Did you have a surgical residency somewhere?
Yeah, at Oklahoma State.
Okay.
That's where I went for surgery residency.
What are a lot of surgeries that you do? What's common in barrel horses?
Arthroscopy is probably the most common thing. I mean, we used to fix a lot of fractures and stuff.
Yeah.
Problem with fixing fractures anymore, they're expensive.
Yeah,
right.
And it's very difficult to get the equipment in the plates and things like that. I mean, when I was at Oklahoma State to fix a elbow fracture, I think we charged like $1,900 or $2,000.
Oh my.
Now that same surgery would probably cost you around $15,000 to $20,000.
Wow.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
So is the horse really worth that much?
Right.
A lot of them come back and do perfectly fine, but some of them don't.
Yeah.
And it, like at our clinic, fixing fractures is hard to do because of the manpower you have to have.
Yeah.
So most of them are arthroscopies. That's probably the majority of them. Colic surgeries, but that's on all the horses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not just barrel horses.
But even those, I mean, surgery is, there's a lot less surgery that we do now than what we used to.
I think it's just so easy for people to, now the inflation with everything, like, it's probably easier for them to find a deal on it. And there's so many horses. There's so many nice horses. So it's like some people just don't want to take that risk. And
yeah.
And a lot more people are breeding. I feel like if it's a mare, it's like way easier for people to just
justify,
like, okay, well, I'll just breed her. Like,
if they get hurt.
Yeah. So there are a couple things that we want to talk about that I think that people in our area in general just could get a little bit more information on. So the first is injections for maintenance. Do you think with barrel horses, like, is that almost considered a routine maintenance for horses that are working that hard? Like, how many barrel horses, I know you've set up here and watched this weekend, how many of them do you think could benefit from injections, joint injections?
A lot.
I opened this can of worms.
It's not just, you know, there's no top athlete out there that's not getting joint maintenance and tissue maintenance, because you're performing at a high level, and if you want to stay at that high level, you have to feel your best. If you're going to do your best, you got to feel your best. Otherwise, if you're hurting all the time, there's, you just can't do it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So you got to treat them like athletes and not just like horses. So if you just want to ride your horse, great. I mean, most horses are perfectly fine without ever getting a needle stuck in them whatsoever.
Yeah.
You want to go trail riding with your horse. You want to go even running barrels if you want to just go out there and have fun and just run around circles.
Not be competitive.
And, but if you want to be competitive, that horse has got to feel good.
Right.
And there's a lot of horses that we watch that that horse don't want to do it because he knows it's going to hurt when he goes out there.
Right.
Yeah.
A lot of these horses that are so-called problem horses that don't, that are just coming around the barrel and saying, ah, I'm going to run up the wall, it's easier that way. A lot of them are hurting somewhere. Not all of them. Some of them are, have emotional issues. But, so, yeah, I mean, a lot of them need it. Routine maintenance, just going and injecting your horse is fine, because, I mean, a lot of horses need it from year to year to year. And when we were using just steroids all the time, that wasn't a really good idea.
Okay.
Because there's some downfalls to using steroids. One, using triamcinolone in horses, some of them it triggers laminitis.
Yeah.
And you don't know which ones it will do that to. Using something like a depomedrol in joints, which the MDs think it's a great idea, it actually is detrimental to the cartilage.
Cartilage, yeah.
So you, they used to say, well, you know, you only get three chances to get this better. Well, it's not going to get better because there's a reason why it keeps on getting inflamed.
Mm-hmm.
And if you keep pushing the horse, of course it's going to be inflamed because you're using the joints.
That makes sense.
So that's how a lot of this regenerative medicine evolved into being used now. And I really haven't found a downside to using it. So like Alpha 2, IRAP, PRP, and things like that, there's not a lot of downside to it. Matter mm-hmm. of fact, when we go into these joints, let's say you had a horse with a chip in the knee or something, the one that had been getting steroid injections, them things look like a bomb went off of them. And when you look at the ones that have had regenerative medicine in them, or just like IRAP or something like that, it, the joint capsule itself is maintained and the rest of the cartilage is maintained and it looks like a joint. So it, there's no real downside to injecting these things. Sure, you're sticking a needle in there, and anytime you stick a needle into a joint, you got a chance of infection, but
right.
That's one of those risk analysis type thing.
Yeah.
Right.
So I think it's good that they do routine maintenance, especially when you want to compete.
Mm-hmm.
So if we had, because I feel like, you know, it's easy when you're a beginner and when you're getting into horses and barrel racing, like it's hard to see lameness right off the bat, and some people are better at it than others. If someone doesn't notice that their horse is sore, or they don't know that they're lame, how often would you think would be a good idea for them to just get a lameness evaluation?
I mean, once a year is probably good.
Okay.
And the main thing is it gives you a chance to go, okay, this is something we got to watch for. And you should always get something to watch for. is he getting muscle weakness in this area and things like that? And should he be doing stretches and things? But yeah, once a year is probably good. Unless you're really competing at a high level, then you're probably going to do it twice a year. But most of the time, if you're competing at that level, you already, oh, my horse just doesn't feel right when I'm doing this.
Yeah.
And they'll be able to tell
that something's off.
If you're a beginner, it's
right.
I mean,
you don't
if
know.
I got on a lame horse, I wouldn't even know it. I really wouldn't.
Right.
We rode lame horses all our life, and we never knew there was anything wrong.
Listen, right. I say all the time that I'm better at seeing it than feeling it. Like, if I think I feel something, I get off and watch, because I'm used to watching for it, not feeling for it.
I'm good at watching for things, not feeling it on the horse until the horse throws me off and says, hey, Fatso, get up there. You
There's
ain't riding
problem.
Me anymore. Because when I was a kid, we never had, there were no vets back then that came out and did a lameness on any of our horses.
Yeah.
And we rode hundreds of horses. I mean, Dad used to come home with this trailer load of horses, and he goes, you get out there and ride them things. Oh, okay.
Right. Yeah, it's just what you did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, they used to go, oh, this horse's back sour. Yeah, he probably had back problems, but nobody ever looked at it.
Yes.
Ever.
Yep. Yep.
Oh,
until
yeah.
the last, what, 5 or 10 years, people really didn't look at back problems in horses.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
And I think that's an interesting point. Like, a lot of people with feral horses say that our industry has grown so much and horses are faster and it's way more competitive. And a lot of people talk about, like, how we've bred barrel horse bloodlines now. We don't just have, you know, race horse. We have barrel horse bloodlines.
Right.
And so a lot of people contribute it to that. But I think a big part of it is veterinary, like, technology has came so far, too. Like, those horses are getting way more treatment than they did even 10 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think it's interesting, too, because, like you said, how everything was, anything that was wrong with the horse, it started in the leg.
Yeah.
And I think that still that's kind of the stereotypical thing.
So
like anything that
happened. Just check their legs.
Yeah,
like,
it's like, because it's like my mare was sore in her neck. Well, I've never had, you know what I mean? Like, that's not something that I feel like anybody even thinks about, as a horse being sore in their neck or, you know. So it's, everybody thinks it's in the foot, but a lot of times it's not actually
there.
They
have a whole body. It's not the legs.
Well, they used to say 80% of the lamenesses are in the foot or below the fetlock. And everybody's like, oh, okay, well, I got a hoof tester. Do I need all that other stuff?
Right.
And farriers run around and say, no foot, no horse.
That's
what they used to. And everybody's like, ooh, I'll go see the farrier. He understands feet.
Right.
Well, that's important.
Yeah.
But so is the rest of the horse.
Yeah, everything.
Yes, everything. The whole horse.
All
and you
around.
Got a lot of people, or even veterinarians, they get focused on just treating, like, oh, well, he's limping on the right front. So what do? They just focus on the right front.
Yeah. When it could be.
When there's the whole other part of the horse. And the reason why he's lame on the right front is because he's got a problem someplace else. So you got to look at the whole horse and not just that one spot.
Yeah. Yep.
But, yeah, it's evolved quite a bit.
Definitely.
And something else that we have a lot of, I think there's a need for and not a lot of education is Lasix.
And there's like a stigma around giving it almost, I feel like.
Yeah, so what's your take on Lasix? And
the real expert is Hinchcliffe.
Mm-hmm.
He was at Ohio State, and he did all the research on Lasix.
Okay.
In racehorses.
Uh-huh.
So anything I know came from him.
Right.
And I mean, there are chapters on Lasix. But Lasix basically is a diuretic drug. Mm-hmm. It pulls basically your electrolytes out via your kidneys and dumps it out, and it drags the water with it. But Hinchcliffe used to say that there's something else with Lasix that helps stabilize blood vessels.
Mm-hmm.
So you're basically reducing the load, the volume, or the pressures in the lungs by reducing volume in the bloodstream.
Right.
Because they reach high pressures into the lungs because the horse is running so hard.
Right.
But there also has to be something else with it that it's actually doing, because otherwise you could just bleed your horse out and or hold it off water for a day and it shouldn't bleed anymore, but it doesn't do that.
Oh, okay.
But we do know that once a horse bleeds, and probably some of the statistics is that probably 80-some percent of the barrel horses bleed, and 100% of the race horses bleed.
Oh, really? 100%? I didn't know that.
They run a lot longer.
Right. Makes sense.
Yeah. So, I mean, a barrel horse would be like a quarter horse racing. So, and not even that far, really.
Right.
Yeah. But
I mean, that is a ton of horses to think about. Like, just think about two drags, and 8 out of 10 of those horses are bleeding. Like, I'm not taking the 20% odds that my horse is not bleeding.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean that they are, and them are statistics, so they can be skewed either plus or minus whatever.
Right.
And, but in when it gets hot out and it's humid out, I mean,
more
we know
likely
that it has a higher incidence. Or if it's really, really dry heat, they do. So is Lasix good? I believe it's good. When a horse is bleeding, basically they're breaking capillaries inside their lungs and it's coming up. And that's why you see some horses that are just blowing blood through their nose afterwards, or it's some of it, most of them probably bleed and they just swallow it and it's fine.
You don't even really know.
You don't even know that they're bleeding. And some of them, you scope them right afterwards and they got like a couple of flakes of blood in there and you're like, oh, okay, well, he is bleeding.
Yeah. Right.
He's just not showing it.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So should you use it as a preventative? I don't know if it is a preventative, but definitely needs it if he is, because there's not a lot of other drugs out there that you can use to control it. We did a stem cell study on some horses and they actually these were definite bleeders because we scoped them.
Mm-hmm.
And after the stem cells, they actually didn't bleed anymore.
Really?
Now, how long? I don't know, because we only gave it, like, I think it was like a month or 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
But it was pretty promising that you can actually heal up their lungs again afterwards with stem cells.
That's very cool.
But we didn't get to cut them open because people were still running them, so. You know.
Yeah.
I haven't taken any lungs out of live horses yet.
Yeah.
Do you see scar tissue from repetitive bleeders? Is that a risk?
Not so much out of bleeders, I don't think. They do, some of them develop like this, for no better word, walking pneumonia, or a low-grade type pneumonia where they're, you can listen to them and it's like they just have this harsh lower lung sound. And a lot of them we put on antibiotics a course of antibiotics, and because that blood sits in there, and it's a good place to set up housekeeping for any bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
So some of them actually need to be treated for it. And they found that in the racehorse industry too.
That's interesting.
That a lot of the, some of those horses, they were a lot better after they were treated with antibiotic therapy.
What are some, like, normal signs? Like, if somebody would come to you, like, what's it typical? Like, something you would think a horse was bleeding? Like, what would something...
Well, the first thing is blood.
Right.
I mean, that's like, some of them is just... Oh, he's coughing after he runs.
Yeah.
He's always going
mm-hmm.
a few times, or he's swallowing a lot.
Oh, okay.
He keeps swallowing and swallowing and swallowing after he gets done running. I mean, some of that can be, you know, it's soft palate displacement in horses. They swallow a lot because they're trying to replace their soft palate in the right spot.
Oh, okay.
But that's... that's probably a good time to start looking at them.
Okay.
Or reduced performance.
Some are just mild.
Mild.
Just your horse isn't clocking how they were, and you checked all the boxes of lameness and things like that. That might be something to think about.
Yeah.
So do you see a ton of side effects from Lasix? Do you feel like overall it outweighs the risks, the benefits outweigh the risks? So do you guys see a lot of side effects from it?
Benefits do outweigh the risk. I don't see a lot of problems with Lasix. If you're giving it all the time at high amounts, probably. Like if your horse is running every day for a week, you really don't want to give them Lasix every single day.
Right.
And that's ridiculous to do that anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, you shouldn't expect them to do that.
Right.
As long as you give it at the proper time, normally the area to give it is 1 to 4 hours, because after 4 hours it's pretty much gone.
Right.
And you can't give them water at the same time. I see a lot of them giving Lasix and then they throw them in the stall and watering them, feeding them.
Right.
Like, well, that kind of defeats the purpose of Lasix.
Right.
But as long as you're like taking them afterwards and replenishing their electrolytes and getting them rehydrated, I think it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Long term, I mean, there's a lot of racehorses that race for many years, and they were on Lasix every time they race, but they don't race as much as barrel horses.
Right.
So, I mean, there's still stuff we don't know how it's going to pan out.
Yeah,
right. Long-term effects maybe.
Yeah.
Or...
and it may have reduced efficacy, too, as time goes on. But, I think the benefits are better than the...
Yeah. Is there anything else that you think is common that maybe is a misconception, or anything that you see that not a lot of barrel racers know about that should?
Well, there's some pretty well-educated and knowledgeable barrel people out there. I mean, there really is.
Yeah.
And they observe a lot of horses.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And learning is all about observation and action.
Right.
I don't know. I mean,
would you think it's fair to say that if your horse, because I think that maybe in our area we're talking about a smaller group of not professional trainers. If they're making runs and their horse has previously been there, done that type of horse, and then all of a sudden things just start falling apart, you think it's time to see the vet?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if your horse was running at, you know, you're running at, you know, 15-second runs, and all of a sudden he's running 15.5, and then now he's down to 16. and it's really no different pens and stuff. Probably something's starting to go wrong.
Yeah, right.
Besides the obvious things, you know, if you're gimping along, I mean, that obviously you
right.
should do something about it. But
yeah. it's not, which to, I guess to you, you could probably look at a lot of horses that like we couldn't see and say, oh, it looks like that horse is sore or whatever. But I think a big misconception is that if a horse isn't three-legged lame, that there's nothing wrong.
Right. right.
Like that's a really big issue like that we yeah. have. It's, or they'll say, well, they run in the field or they take that lead in the field, but they don't want to take it whenever we ride. So they assume that, you know, people just assume that because that horse will do that and they'll use that leg or whatever in the field, that there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to take your lame horse and turn him out in the field, most of them aren't lame anymore. They're like, woohoo!
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
I don't know,
cool
I got three legs, but I don't need that other one.
Right.
I can drag it.
Right. Yeah.
And they do that, and them running around by themselves is a lot different than them doing their job.
Right.
God never built a horse to go run around a can.
Right.
He
right.
really didn't.
Right.
Right.
We did that to him. And
yeah.
there's a lot more, the subtleties in a sore horse or lame horse or horse that, well, he's just not doing right or mm-hmm. he's a little bit off. But, who cares?
Yeah.
Those, sometimes there's a lot more to it
yeah.
than what meets the eye.
Yeah.
Right, so basically just because you can't see that horse limping down the road, that doesn't mean that there isn't like an issue, basically.
Right, because there's a lot of times I'll do like all the flexions and everything, but I already usually know what's going on before I even do that.
Right.
Yeah.
The reason why we do it is to find out if there's something else that hurts.
Gotcha. That could maybe be causing that or vice versa, basically, like compensation.
Just another area that's
right.
not
yeah.
the primary.
Because just because, like, today we looked at a horse with an SI problem. Well, that's the biggest problem right now, but the reason why he had an SI problem because the other side was injured at one time.
Well, and that's what I was going to say, too, is I think that a lot of times people think, well, I went to the vet. I've already been there, so and we injected this, so they don't want to come back. And it's like sometimes it takes two or three trips, or it takes two or three phases. To actually find the root cause of what caused all of this
yeah,
stuff.
Sometimes you got to treat what hurts so you can get to what caused it.
Yes.
Gotcha.
And
that's a good way of putting it.
Yes,
yeah.
I mean,
exactly.
You got to, and that's a step process. It sucks because, you know, some people drive 3 hours
yeah,
away.
Like
and
me.
It's like,
like me.
Yeah, and it's like, well, I hate to make you come back. I'd like to do everything all at once,
but
you
can't.
Take a step.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, so it's not always like a one step. Because that's what we see that a lot. It's like, well, we were just at the vet and we just had hawks done. But
they'll
the horse
go to
the
vet one time and then they just like never go back because they're like, well, that vet
didn't
find the
it.
Problem or it didn't fix it.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's a phase.
I mean,
thing.
We get people in there that, oh, well, his worst spot is this and that's all I can afford. Well, good. Let's do that.
Yeah.
But save your money because you're probably going to have to do the other side because that usually pops up or this
yeah.
or that. So you got to deal with what the hand that you got dealt
yeah.
right.
a lot of times. And you don't want to go into a horse and go, well, I'm going to inject every joint in this horse and then I'll hit something, surely.
Right. right.
But
yeah.
you kind of want to limit it. And sometimes, like, I'll do, like, I know that there's other things, but I want to see how well it gets after we treat this
right.
spot.
Yep.
And then we can see how much of a problem that really is.
Yeah. Right.
Well, we won't take up any more of your time. We know that you're a busy man and you have clients waiting on you, but we really appreciate you
<I'm busy>.
sitting down and taking the time to talk with us. I think it was really informational.
It was,
and
yeah.
A lot of knowledge gained for me personally. So thanks for doing it. We're happy to have you. And I'm super glad that counselor lit a fire under your butt.
Yeah, me
because
too.
I don't know what Hank would do without you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I usually do things because somebody told me I couldn't. That's pretty much, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that I did in veterinary medicine is because everybody says, well, you can't do that. And it's like, well, why not?
Right.
I'm going to try it.
Right.
Yep.
And if you don't try, you're not ever going to.
Yeah. Well, and that's where innovation comes from. That's
it
how
is.
Our industry grows and the
yeah.
veterinary medicine industry grows.
I mean, all of veterinary medicine, was even human medicine, was through trial and error.
It absolutely was.
Yep.
Yes. Yep. That's for sure.
Yeah. I mean, don't cut his arm off because it's not going to grow back.
Right. Right.
Let's not dissect live humans.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's true.
But they used to.
Oh, yep. They used to do. I mean, that's unfortunately how we have a lot
I mean,
of information.
My mom's got these old books that I used to look through when I was a kid, and they give you nightmares looking at them. Because she was a nurse, so.
Oh, okay.
She had all these old nursing books, and you're like, oh, I never wanted to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but that yeah, it's true. That is unfortunately how a lot
I mean,
of information has been gained.
Yeah.
And a lot of people have done. The lameness modality, if you look at it too, it doesn't always have to be a medicine that you're injecting. Because medicine isn't perfect by any means at all, really.
Yeah.
Because otherwise we'd be curing everything.
Right, yeah.
And the medical industry makes billions and trillions of dollars by not curing anything.
Right, yeah. Yeah, that's true.
So there's other modalities like acupuncture helps.
Mm-hmm.
But the chiropractic helps, massage therapy, the, you know, the... pulse magnetic therapies and lasers and shockwave, all those came about because one, we always were trying to get more to spark a better healing process and things like that.
Right.
So like, you know, the herbals came up.
Uh-huh.
Pretty hot and heavy and like, early 2000s,
yeah.
That herbals really started taking effect. I mean, they used to have, started with like no butte.
Yeah.
Right.
And things like that.
Yeah.
And now we got driven products.
Yes, which we do.
Which use
we
quite
are
often.
Fan of.
CBD
yeah.
oil. Yeah.
Yes.
So that's all good.
Scott Brown.
You've seen a lot of benefits out of their wound care stuff.
Oh, yeah, I like their wound care
yeah.
product.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good product.
Me too.
Yep.
I think they just need more.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
I took it myself. I mean, after my shoulder surgery,
did
I took
help?
CBD oil, and it was like, I wasn't on any pain meds, none
wow.
whatsoever.
Really?
Never took an Advil or nothing.
Wow.
All I took was CBD oil.
Wow. Cool.
And
that's really cool. Yep.
And it came from Scott. He sent it to me. Afterwards, because he texted me and said, "You want some of this?" And I was like, "Sure."
Yeah.
So it worked good.
Cool. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Good to have some real life, you know, reviews on that.
Yeah,
kind
and
of
I think
stuff.
It's really cool to hear a veterinarian say like some of those products and
mm-hmm.
therapies and things like that because it is a collective.
Well, and I mean, at one point, that's all people had. And
it is, and
you know?
Well, I mean, most medicines probably started out as, you know, you see the movies where they're trekking through the jungle to find that one ant that may have,
yeah.
you know, this
yes.
healing effect for cancer, and
right.
they all end up dying and being eaten by an anaconda. But
yeah.
But a lot of it came from herbals, and like, look at aspirin. That aspirin came from salicylic acid from a willow tree. It's purified by Bayer.
Right.
Who turned it into usable form instead of chewing on a willow tree.
Right.
Because not everybody has access to that.
Yep.
Yeah.
But, you know, it just evolved over time.
Yeah.
I think we've came a long way, and there's a longer way to go, probably.
Oh, a lot.
It'd be cool to see where
in
we are.
In 10 years, we're all going to be like, God, we were so stupid back then.
Why did we do that?
I do that, like, every year. I'm like, I can't believe I was that stupid.
Why did they come out with one injection that takes care of any lameness, maintenance, any? It'd be bad for you.
I think it would be great if I came up with an injection for people not to hit barrels.
So, me too.
If you could please come up with that.
I have this one injection. You'll never hit a barrel.
If you can come up with an injection to train horses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of joint injections, which we're almost done, but I did want to ask because I know people are going to be like, why did you not ask that? What about four joints? People always want to supplement. What would be, like, what do you like to recommend for, like, joint maintenance, like Adequan or something like that? I mean, do you see that that helps, things like that, or?
Yes and no. So, Adequan came about because somebody found out that they could inject it. But, so Adequan is basically purified bovine cartilage, and they get it from the tracheas,
okay.
And they grind it up. There's only one place in the world that makes the ingredients for Adequan.
Mm-hmm.
And what we, when they first came on the market, everybody was like, "Oh, you just give them Adequan, that's fine." And we weren't really injecting a lot of joints back then. And they said, well, you can inject this in the joint too, and you can do this. A lot of people got away from injecting it into joints. But the reason for it is you're supposed to get 4 days of anti-inflammatory with every shot, and it reduces the anti-inflammatory or the inflammation in the joints. That's fine. It's labeled as a chondroprotective, meaning it's supposed to protect the cartilage. And we've seen in herds early on that if you give it to foals, that there's a less incidence of OCD lesions in those foals.
Mm-hmm.
Is it 100%? Not even close.
Right.
But it does help.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And like Adequan, if you give it to a horse that just got injected,
uh-huh.
It seems that it helps draw out those times that the horse needs to be injected.
Okay.
Is it in every horse? No.
Right, but it can.
But you see more profound effect in dogs and people than you do in a horse.
Really?
And a lot of times it's because we're probably not using high enough doses in horses.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
The joint supplements, like HA products, bacteria loves HA. So if you get a bacteria in your HA product, you probably don't have any HA left.
Oh.
So the ones that are selling jugs of HA, they probably put it in there, but it's probably not available.
Really? Okay.
Sitting on your shelf or in your dusty old barn or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
If it's refrigerated, it lasts longer.
Okay.
So the handling part of a lot of these products lessens their degree. Yeah,
okay.
It just, and they don't tell you this.
Right, yeah, I didn't know that. Yeah.
So like these feeds with HA in them, yeah, they probably put HA in there, but did it really make it to the extrusion process with the high temperature? Okay, maybe. I don't
mm-hmm.
know.
Mm-hmm.
I never tested any of them.
Right.
But I know that early on when all these supplements really started taking off, I was in resident, and they did a little project on some products, and they were able to see how much, I think at that time it was chondroitin sulfate in these things. Most of them, some of the cheap ones never even had any, they couldn't even detect it in their little scoop. Higher end definitely had it. I mean, the chondroitin, like the Chondroflex and things like that, they got some research behind it and did a good job.
Right.
Probably the important ones are like, they can make a really good HA product now and comes in individual packages. They're probably the best ones to use.
Okay.
The Sound Science Nutrition, not to give them a thing, but they did a good job on their packaging mm-hmm. and availability of that product. HA though is pretty short lived in your body, or once you take it, because as soon as HA hits your liver, it's gone.
Okay.
So you got about 2 minutes of HA, whether you give IV Legend or not. It's just disappears. Whatever absorbs as the blood passes over your joints and stuff, that's the only thing going into your body.
Wow.
And we've found a lot of uses for HA too. I mean, helping to, it probably helps in ulcer prevention.
Okay. Well, I've seen that recently.
Yeah, so they're working on that, and a lot of the linoleic acids and fatty acids are a big thing now, too.
Mm-hmm.
So it all plays a role on good nutrition. So it helps. Are you going to be able to give a horse Adequan that's got arthritis? It's probably may help him a little bit, but you're not going to go, ooh, well, he's not lame anymore. I'll just go run.
Right. It can be a...
It helps.
Gotcha.
That's all it is, a helper.
Right. Okay, cool. I think a lot of people use it or know about it at least, so good information
for
people to
have. Yeah, there's like so many...
There is.
So-called nutraceuticals out there anymore that...
Yeah.
Sometimes it's hard to weed through, you know, what's going
there's
to be
so
beneficial
much stuff.
And what's
oh, it
not.
Is.
And
so
like you said
stuff.
Earlier, statistics can be manipulated and studies can. And so.
Oh, yeah, like all the time.
Right.
You know, and unless you're a scientist, basically, to know what studies you can believe and what you can't, and the ones that aren't funded by certain pharmaceutical companies and all of those things, you know, it's hard. It's tough to know the difference. So I think that's good information.
Yeah, for sure. Well, we won't keep you any longer. We appreciate it very much.
Oh,
we know
welcome.
You've got people waiting on you, so we'll let you go.
All right.
But thank you, guys.
Thanks
for listening to our podcast, where we're not so rich,
not so famous,
but we're all trying to be.